Hello everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we're going to look at the split from Al-Qaeda on the part of Jabhat al-Nusra and what we like to call its rebranding. And this topic I find interesting, and I'm giving it sort of a cheesy name, but I like calling the show What's in a Name. So today we have David Gardenstein-Ross back on the show. He's been a longtime guest on the show. And first of all, welcome back, David.
Thanks, Chelsea. It's always great to join the Loopcast, which I think is one of the absolute most valuable national security podcasts that anyone can find.
Oh, you're too kind, and we love having you as a guest. So I know this is going to be a fantastic show. David is very strong and great on this topic. He's been watching Al-Qaeda for years, so he's the perfect expert for the show. And for our listeners who might not know of David, he is a counterterrorism scholar and analyst, and he is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And in 2014, he became the CEO of Valens Global, which is a private company that consults on counterterrorism, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISL, whatever you want to call that group, other insurgent groups, and violent non-state actors. And he's also the author of a number of books, including Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. So, David, we've recently had this change of name on the part of Jabhat al-Nusra, aka JN, to make a shorter acronym. And they've now changed their name to Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, which is also acronym JFS, and broke their ties with Al-Qaeda. So, to start off with, what is going on?
So to start off with what is going on, let's add the word allegedly. They allegedly broke their ties with Al-Qaeda. If one were to ask, despite the breaking of ties, are they still a part of the Al-Qaeda organization, despite the express breaking of ties? My answer would be, with great certainty, yes, they are. And I want to get into why I think that's the case. But if you look at the statements that are being made coming out of Nusra / JFS, these aren't statements that go much of a way to actually breaking ties with Al-Qaeda at all. Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, the head of JFS, had said, and what Mustafa Muhammad, another one of the group's leaders who spoke to CNN, said, is basically the same turn of phrase. Both of them said that they don't receive directives from an external entity. Now, what does that mean, that they don't receive directives from an external entity? My view is that previously they would find it fair to consider Al-Qaeda's senior leadership to be an external entity, given that Zawahiri was based in South Asia, and you didn't have a strong contingent of Al-Qaeda senior leaders in Syria. Today, though, you do. I mean, that's well known that the Khorasan group is present in Syria, which is a group of Al-Qaeda senior leaders who migrated from the Khorasan region, from Afghanistan, Pakistan, over to Syria. And so there's no reason that when they say they don't receive directives from an external entity, that the AQSL members in Syria are not considered to be a part of an external entity. You have to read their language very carefully. Second thing is that it's known that Jilani, the group's emir, had bayat to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the emir of Al-Qaeda. He hasn't said anything about his bayat to Zawahiri. He hasn't said that he's breaking or renouncing the bayat. And furthermore, if you look at the press conference itself, when Jilani announced the alleged break, he was surrounded by longtime Al-Qaeda cohorts. If you look into the individuals who were there, they too have long-standing relationships to Al-Qaeda. The next thing is that the reaction from Al-Qaeda clerics has been very, very positive. Like, no Al-Qaeda clerics are arguing that this was a bad thing. In fact, they've argued about what the strategic advantages are. So you've had statements issued since then, all of them very similar, from Abu Qatada and Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, both of whom are based in Jordan, who have favored the so-called split from Al-Qaeda. and also from Abdullah al-Muhassini, who's also a high-level al-Qaeda cleric. Muhassini has said that other Syrian militant factions should understand that Jilani's move gave priority to the interests of the nation over the interests of the faction, and that he further said that all the Syrian militant factions should now align with Nusra, since the obstacle that they used as an excuse, that is the affiliation with al-Qaeda, has been removed. One final thing I want to point out here that finishes the tableau as to why I do not see this as being an actual split is that originally this was the plan for Nusra, to have Nusra be an organization that was a part of al-Qaeda's orbit, but that did not publicly announce it. If you look at when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and ISIS moved into Syria and claimed jurisdiction over Nusra, which was one of the origins of the friction between the two groups, at that time, Nusra was not an announced part of al-Qaeda. Jilani's hand was forced in terms of admitting that Nusra was a part of al-Qaeda, but originally the plan was to have it to be an unacknowledged part of al-Qaeda, similar to how Ansar Sharia in Tunisia, Ansar Sharia in Libya, have been parts of al-Qaeda, like definitive parts, but haven't been clear about their association with it, and that is a model that's used elsewhere. In Libya, for example, the Derna Mujahideen Shura Council very clearly has a relationship with al-Qaeda that they're not really publicly discussing. This group in the post-Arab Spring world has, for a variety of reasons, including strategic reasons that we can see at play in Syria, has been making use of front groups and been making use of affiliates that don't quite come out and say that they're affiliates.
And with what you just mentioned about this split potentially being, or what we can call a potential split, we don't even know really, it being something that was always planned. And then we've heard other people arguing that there's been elements in JN for a while, since about 2013, looking for a split. Do you think this is a combination of the two?
It's hard to say. There's multiple elements, right? And there may be, I'm sure that there are some more nationalist elements who want a split. Then I think there are some elements who say that they want a split, but they want a fake split, right? Given that there's very clearly a PR move and a rebranding at play. And so both sets of factions can coexist. And I don't think that anyone could say, I think it would be difficult to say definitively that factions that wanted it, that genuinely wanted a split, that didn't want it to be a fake split, represent the majority, and they certainly don't represent the leadership. Both can be a factor, but I'm not convinced that there's a huge groundswell for a genuine split from al-Qaeda. There certainly has been no evidence, and given some of the opacity that's at play, what I would focus on is the signaling at top levels, at least as representative of how the leadership in the organization sees it. Now, there's an argument there, okay? I think that there is an argument to be made that even if this is intended as a fake split, that it can actually cause Nusra to break from what people describe as al-Qaeda's global agenda. I think that phrasing itself is a little bit loaded. I think al-Qaeda does not have a purely global agenda. I think that they do have a near enemy strategy in addition to a far enemy strategy, and I think that in recent years the near enemy strategy has eclipsed the far enemy strategy. So I think there is some misconception of al-Qaeda that has and their goals that has been at play. But that being said, it does open up possibilities to take what may be intended as a fake split and actually make it much more of a genuine split. But in order for us to take advantage, what we need to do is understand what game they're playing and what they actually intend. One of the big problems with CT analysis has been people reading in, misreading organizations and mixing up their aspirations for where they would like the organizations to be with where they actually are. I think for us to take advantage of this split, we need to have a cold look at what it's actually intended to do, and then from there discuss what vulnerabilities are created. But those vulnerabilities of making it more local or making it a genuine split from Al-Qaeda, I don't think are going to play themselves out on their own.
You mentioned earlier that this potentially could be a big PR, public relations ploy or stunt. How really realistic is that?
Very realistic. Because it's not aimed at the West. If you look at U.S. officials and Western officials, yeah, they're not fooled, okay? They're not going to fool the United States. But the fact is, there's multiple things that they can gain. If you look at what's happened in recent days since the JFS alleged split from Al-Qaeda, it has broken the siege of Aleppo, at least according to its own propaganda. I think that it's early days, so I wouldn't at all say that this will continue. But they were able to claim that they'd broken the siege of Aleppo, which had been really front and center in the Arab media for some time. The U.S. has not been aggressively pushing back on the idea that Nusra / JFS had split from Al-Qaeda. Because the U.S. hasn't been aggressively pushing it, I think they're going to be able to claim this rebrand. So other things that are at play is it makes it easier for other rebel factions to work with JFS / Nusra because they allegedly are no longer a part of Al-Qaeda. So the stigma that attaches to Al-Qaeda is diminishing with respect to JFS / Nusra. One further consideration is for a while, Nusra, even when it was officially a part of Al-Qaeda, received state support from Turkey, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, and it also, very clearly, undeniably, with 100% certainty, had U.S.-backed rebels help it to make advances using weapons that the U.S. had given to it. Now, that's not, conspiracy theory. That's horrible U.S. strategy. But at the end of the day, if JFS / Nusra isn't, redesignated a terrorist organization by the U.S., by the United Nations, by the European Union, and the like, if the stigma slips from working with it, they're going to have more people working with them, they're going to have more state support, and quite possibly more in the way of private support. That's what the rebranding is. It's not fooling Americans. It's putting themselves in a position where they can operate more openly in the region. And even while they were officially a part of Al-Qaeda, they'd actually been able to operate pretty openly and get state support. This opens them up to more.
What sort of impact have the U.S. and Russian airstrikes potentially had on this choice to, I'm going to put in air quotes, break from AQ?
Oh, there's no question about that. Multiple commentators have fingered, and correctly, that the U.S. had been talking to Russia about cooperating on the targeting of Nusra prior to this announced split. And one of the purposes of announcing the split was to make it harder for the U.S. to aid Russia strikes against Nusra / JFS.
So this is a good thing for JFS or JN, whatever we're going to call them nowadays, I guess JFS. So also we recently had a CNN interview with Mustafa Mohammed, who, as you mentioned, is one of JFS's leaders, and he's also someone that's designated a global terrorist by the U.S. government in May 2016. And so CNN gave Mohammed the opportunity to discuss via a taped interview about this split. I thought this is a very interesting development, and I wanted to know your thoughts on it, because is it now all right for mainstream media to provide an outlet for terror groups or individuals of terror groups?
I think there was never a time when the mainstream media couldn't do that. If you look at why Peter Bergen became famous, he had gone and interviewed Osama bin Laden prior to the 9/11 attacks. Like, that's why he was launched into such prominence. He'd just come out with the book Holy War, Inc. at the time of the 9/11 attacks. And that was fine. Nobody had a problem with that. Nobody felt that Bergen had acted unethically by interviewing bin Laden. So I don't have a problem with CNN doing that now. I do think that it's important to contextualize that these guys may not be what they say that they are, and likely are not what they say that they are. I think that it's important to contextualize the questions around whether this is a genuine split. But I think it's fine to interview them. And moreover, they're certainly being interviewed in the Arab world, which is their core target audience. So I don't think that there's a reason CNN couldn't do that. It's not material support, just as a whole variety of unsavory characters, from murder suspects to dictators, are interviewed by the mainstream media. It's not to propagandize for them. Rather, it's to report on what major and consequential figures are saying. And JN/JFS is indeed major and consequential.
And as you mentioned, at least when I viewed the interview, it seemed like a great propaganda piece. Mohammed really made JFS sound sweet and innocent, and we're here to help Syria, and the typical propaganda of that conflict. And in the interview, he also mentioned being completely independent from AQ, and I know you've touched on this and the reality of this statement, but why don't we look at that a little bit deeper?
Yeah, I mean, the statement was that with the formation of JFS, we are completely independent. That means we don't report to anyone, we don't receive our directives from any external entity. And I would put a lot of weight on the very end of that phrase. Look, for one thing, it's not as though these groups don't lie, right? Like, I wouldn't necessarily, I wouldn't take it at face value that just because a spokesman says that they have, that they are now completely independent, that means that they are completely independent. And the use of the phrase, we don't receive directives from any external entity, which is similar to what Jelani had said, is, I think, a fairly significant. Look, at the end of the day, if you look at for example, Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, which is very clearly was an al-Qaeda front group, had said, they talked about how they admired al-Qaeda and had the same methodology, but they flat out denied that they were a part of al-Qaeda. There's this phrase which I think is doing a lot of work, the external entity phrase. This has more of a suggestion than I would say Jelani's original statement of actually splitting from al-Qaeda. But I don't believe it, right? You don't see al-Qaeda members being distressed at one of the most powerful branches of the organization leaving, right? Like, instead, everyone's all the al-Qaeda leaders are praising this. When you look at old al-Qaeda hands who are who'd gone to Nusra, they're still there. They're not leaving the Nusra JFS territory. So, it is what they are saying, with I think some phrasing which is very deliberate in nature. But I don't see evidence that this is genuine, and in fact, I think the evidence significantly points to the contrary. It points to their reversion to what their original plan was before the ISIS challenge rolled in. And I think it's worth also noting that this, given that this was their original plan, this was Nusra's original plan, it seems like one of the things that's at play is they assess ISIS to be a diminishing challenge. Initially, I think that they might have broken last year, but the reason why they didn't break, quote unquote, break from al-Qaeda is because of the fact that that would have been perceived throughout the jihadist world as al-Qaeda falling apart. And it might have actually threatened other al-Qaeda affiliates with leaving at a time when ISIS was making a full-court press to try to win over al-Qaeda's affiliates. And now you know, ISIS, even though it's able to launch a large number of terrorist attacks abroad, I think that ISIS is in decline. It's not as compelling. It's not as powerful. It doesn't have the same kind of pull that it did before. And I think that is one of the reasons that they feel fine about announcing this split now.
And something you touched on, the idea that there are still a lot of AQ individuals, operatives in the region where JN, now JFS, is, it really sense it for me, it causes the sense of you still have these individuals there. So realistically looking at that, how strong could a potential break between AQ be if you still have individuals that potentially have either emotional or logistical connection to AQ? And I would love you to discuss that a bit, because you have individuals that are longtime AQ members, and then all of a sudden we have this so-called split. It just, for me, brings up red flags.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the movement into, like, within the region, you have a strong AQ presence in a number of different ways. One, which I mentioned before, is the Khorasan group, which is a group that is comprised of al-Qaeda senior leaders, which has been based around Syria and Turkey. And recently, the Washington Post made very clear that the Khorasan group and other al-Qaeda senior leaders have been given significant ability to operate into Turkey. So people who've been part of the Khorasan group include, for example, Sanafi al-Nasser and David Drujan, both of whom are now deceased, but also Mohammed Islam Bulli has been publicly named as another major Khorasan group figure. The group itself has not been destroyed. It's been bombed a few times. It certainly hasn't been destroyed. You have al-Qaeda clerics operating much more openly. I mentioned a couple of them earlier, Abu Qatada and Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, both of whom have been released from prison in Jordan. They've been able to, in part, play off of the Jordanian concerns about ISIS. Almost certainly one of the reasons they're able to be back on the street and operating openly is because they're anti-ISIS, and Jordan views them as potentially a strong bulwark against ISIS growth within Jordan. You've had well-publicized major al-Qaeda loyalists who were within another group that Nusra has fought, slash JFS has fought in coalition with, that being Ahrar al-Sham. Not marginal figures who have been very key to these organizations, who played a strong role within these organizations. And ultimately, you know, all the al-Qaeda figures, no al-Qaeda figure is condemning this split. None of them is alarmed by it. They all seem to think that it's a very good idea, and all of them emphasize the same thing, which is that this now removes the excuse of any militant faction in Syria that didn't want to work with Nusra because of the al-Qaeda brand. Now, let me be very clear. This was al-Qaeda's strategy for the Arab Spring. Bin Laden, quite famously, wrote a letter from Abbottabad talking about how al-Qaeda should operate under different brands. He considered changing al-Qaeda's name. And their strategy after al-Qaeda in Iraq's loss in the 2007-09 period, al-Qaeda in Iraq, of course, being ISIS's predecessor, their strategy was to move towards more of a population-centric approach, and an approach that favored localization, where al-Qaeda branches were seen as much more of a part of the local aspirations, of the organic aspirations that people had locally. And so, you know, this is very much in line with that brand that they have been trying to take on. It's something that both is meant to appeal to locals, to militant groups that are active on a local level, and also to make it easier for donors and other external supporters to support them, because now they're claiming to be more of a local militant group claiming to downplay some of those global aspirations that al-Qaeda was so known for.
So could we potentially call this a grand Al-Qaeda initiative, this idea of the split with JN-JFS?
Yeah, I mean, look, you'll find plenty of people who disagree, to be very clear. And you mentioned before that there are differences in analytic conclusions. So one thing that I always emphasize is it's important for all of us to check back and see who's getting these things right. My answer is yes. That is what it is. As I said, people, you know, there's disagreement among experts. You can there are plenty of people who you could interview who would give you the opposite answer. But I think that what we can look for is, you know, number one, what is its relationship with other Al-Qaeda branches and Al-Qaeda fighters after, you know, after this supposed split occurs? Number two, is it acting like other Al-Qaeda or unacknowledged Al-Qaeda branches? Number three, at some point, you know, communications between Nusra and other parts of Al-Qaeda will be intercepted. Do these communications suggest that, in fact, it is a part of Al-Qaeda? Number four, there's the question of the bayat that Jilani has to Zawahiri. Does he maintain that relationship of bayat post the alleged split? Those are a few questions. Those are a few of the things that one can look to determine who is right. So look, there's a split opinion, and people who are really interested in this should hear what analysts have to say on the other side. But for my money, I'm putting the probability of this, my confidence level, very high. I'd put it at 95% confidence that this is in fact an Al-Qaeda initiative, that in fact it is something which is, you know, approved of and is part of a plan at top levels, as opposed to an organic push from factions who legitimately wanted to break from Al-Qaeda.
Going back to the CNN interview with Mohammed, he points out that as the Nusra Front, the group only was really focusing on Syria in the recent scheme of things, and that now as JFS, they're going to do the same. So they basically have no intentions of shifting their policies to the West. A, what are your thoughts on this? And B, to me, this sounds like very much saying, you know, we are here to, without saying it, should I say, we are here to save the Syrians from other groups like ISIS that's much more potentially extreme than us, JFS. We're here to free the Syrian people of ISIS and Assad and yada, yada, yada. So let's hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the message that they're sending, that they're there to free the Syrian people from Assad and ISIS, with the emphasis being on Assad. You know, he's correct that Nusra's focus, when it was a part of Al-Qaeda, was local. Although, you know, you do have the Khorasan group, which, you know, as has been reported, had ambitions or plans to strike externally, and it housed the Khorasan group. But this is where we often, it's surprising to me that sometimes there are mistaken views amongst analysts as to what Al-Qaeda's strategy is. Sometimes it's said that, you know, what Al-Qaeda's strategy is to strike the West or to attack the far enemy. And, you know, that has, in recent years, very clearly changed. I haven't seen a good study that actually outlines what its far enemy strategy is. That's something which I'm hoping to do myself. But they don't have a pure far enemy strategy at this point. The reason why in the 1990s, Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadists decided that striking the far enemy, that is the United States and the West, should be their priority, is because of the view that if they were able to topple the near enemy, that is so-called apostate regimes within the region, that outside actors like the U.S. or France would step in and save those local regimes. Something they pointed to as an example was the Algerian Civil War, where the Algerian government received support from France in order to make sure that Islamic militants wouldn't topple the Algerian regime. Post-Arab Spring, it's actually very clear that the far enemy is nowhere near as capable of preserving local regimes as it once was. You know, the topic of Ben Ali and Mubarak, of course, those were not done by jihadists. They were brought down by protests. and you know, subsequently in Egypt, subsequently in both states, you had, you know, Islamist parties come to power, and then more secular leaning parties replaced them. In Egypt, that happened via a coup. In Tunisia, that happened through the electoral system. But then you have Libya, where in Libya, after the U.S. intervened to very foolishly remove Muammar Gaddafi, you haven't had the state put back together, and jihadists have a tremendous amount of operating space, controlling a great deal of territory on the ground. In Syria, of course, jihadists are a big part of the landscape, and the outside powers are able to do very little about that. There are other places where you have where outside powers aren't able to dislodge the jihadist presence. You do have heavy insurgencies in both Somalia and Mali, where Al-Qaeda is at the forefront of them, and most likely in Somalia they'll end up, as AMISOM, the African Union mission there, draws down, they'll end up controlling territory. In Yemen, the Yemeni state has collapsed. Outside actors aren't able to keep it together, and Al-Qaeda is able to control a great deal of ground, including, they withdrew from the fifth largest city of Yemen, from the port city of Mukalla, but they control all of the surrounding territory, and they still control a large strip along the coast. So the strategic outlook that prompted them to adopt this far enemy strategy in the 1990s just no longer applies to today's world. So for Mustafa Mohammed's statement, I don't think it's inaccurate. It's not fully accurate, because I do think that ultimately a group like Nusra/JFS controlling territory does pose an external threat. I actually don't think there's a question about that. But in the near term, they are near enemy focused. They're not focused on striking the West. But that is entirely in line with what Al-Qaeda's strategy has become. If you look from theater to theater, in terms of where there's a strong Al-Qaeda presence, it's been more focused on the battle at hand and less focused on external operations. That's the case with the Al-Qaeda franchise in Yemen, even though there have been some terrorist plots aimed at Western targets coming out of Yemen. That was the case for Nusra. It's the case for the various Al-Qaeda groups in Libya. It's the case for Al-Qaeda franchise in Tunisia, which is Katibat Uqba ibn Nafi. It's the case in Mali, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Maghreb, has also carried out a number of attacks on Western targets in West African hotels. So it's generally near enemy focus, with some strikes at the far enemy. But if you look at their military operations, much more of the military operations from one Al-Qaeda branch to the next have been focused not on the far enemy, but on the near enemy.
So you've touched on this in the talk already slightly, but if this split, if it's really a split between JN and AQ, is for real, what will JFS gain from this split?
Well, if it is a real split, what JFS gains is, if they are focused not on the on striking at the West, but instead focused on the near enemy, and they really don't have any external ambitions, then it allows them to operate at a regional level while diminishing the extent to which they'd be targeted by Western CT or counterinsurgent forces, and also removes the stigma of working with Al-Qaeda. What it cost them is lack of access to the Al-Qaeda network's resources and support. But ultimately, this is a question of what their priorities are, whether it's really merely regional or whether they have more global ambitions. And let's be very clear, a group can function regionally while still having broader ambitions and thus function as a part of a network. In other words, if you look at what Nusra had done previously, it fell in line with kind of the think globally, act locally mantra that as applied to jihadists, and that it embedded the Khorasan group within it. It had operatives moving through Nusra, senior Al-Qaeda operatives who would move through and embed with Nusra. All of these are things that organization did, which are consistent with preparing for something that is not just limited to Syria, but rather which extends beyond the borders of Syria.
And on that point, do we even know what JFS's future goals might be?
Well, it depends on whether I'm right or wrong, right? Like, if I'm correct about it, it's actually not that difficult to understand their future goals. If I'm correct, it's, you know, embed themselves further with rebel populations in Syria. It's, you know, host Al-Qaeda senior leadership, work in conjunction with them while publicly downplaying its connection to Al-Qaeda. It's put itself in a position where it can control territory, basically, you know, either a proto-emirate or perhaps a declared emirate, and serve as an arm of Al-Qaeda's global strategy, if I'm correct. If I'm incorrect, then it's something, you know, more regional, more local, and then there'd be more of a question mark over what it's going to be doing strategically.
If this is in fact a split, will JFS meet its objectives by doing this?
If it is a split, your question is, will they meet their objectives by splitting?
Correct.
If it is a split, then yeah, I think that I think that it probably will help them meet their objectives. As I've made clear, I don't think it's a genuine split, and I think that actually, even if it's not a split, it helps them to achieve their objectives by helping to advance this rebranding posture that had started long ago under Al-Qaeda, initiated by Al-Qaeda senior leadership.
So, David, you've been on the show a number of times, and you know that when we have time permitting, we like to give our guests a moment of thought. So if there's something we might not have touched on in the show, or something that you'd really like to add, I'd like to hand the floor over to you.
I think this is another interesting area, because we've gotten into areas in the past when I've been on the Loopcast, where there have been, you know, splits in expert opinion, sometimes very heated ones. And this is an area where, as I made clear, you know, without disparaging anyone, where there is very clearly a split in expert opinion. So I would point back to the last show which I did, which I thought was very good. That was with me and Tom Nichols, where we were having a follow-up on the discussion we'd had on expertise. And we talked at some length about Philip Tetlock's new book, and how Tetlock argues correctly that we need more of a metric in terms of keeping track in the world of punditry. And I applied that to an analysis of violent non-state actors. I've been very clear over the past few years, so I'm not saying anything that will surprise anyone who's familiar with my work, that I think the field has done a poor job of understanding and predicting jihadist organizations. I think that to me, as I said on my show, the show with Tom, I think that good descriptive understanding of these groups will be reflected in predictive analysis. So I think here, as we have had multiple times before, we have a clear split in opinion about what this development means. And I would encourage people who want to know, to improve the state of the field, to pay attention to these splits, and let's track them, and let's see who gets things right. Not really so that we can enforce one set of personalities over another, but so that we can become better as a field and understanding where our analysis goes wrong and why. And the final thing I'll say in that regard is that if I am correct that this is not a genuine split, there's a real cost to not understanding that. And I think that is actually the world that we are absolutely going to be in, where the U.S. doesn't act to counter this PR move, and it gives JFS/Nusra a greater ability to operate in the region when they already have a lot of ability to operate. And so having the wrong conception of what our sets of enemies are up to can have a significant impact in retarding our ability to execute strategy and to shift strategically even when the enemy is doing so.
Well, this has been a really fascinating and insightful talk. And once again, thank you so much for lending your expertise and thought on this, David, and being such a loyal guest to the Loopcast.
thank you. It's always a pleasure and honor to be a part of the Loopcast. You all do phenomenal work, and Chelsea, I hope that it can continue even while you move into this even busier part of your life with your fellowship and your academic work. Many congratulations on all of that, and you know, I hope you're very proud of this great product that you've given to everyone, because I know that it's my go-to podcast that I listen to when I drive, and I know that lots of people in the national security field feel the exact same way.
Thank you, David. And yes, for you and our listeners, my goal is to do very good time management and keep the Loopcast going, because it is a baby of me and everyone who's been involved. So that is the goal.